The great thing about philosophy is it allows you to be a parasite on the other disciplines, and so you can write about a lot of different stuff. I sort of discovered this. That wasn't the kind of the original plan, but honestly, I tend to write and focus on the things that I think are the sort of relevant crossroads to history. And years ago, I got really frustrated that otherwise faithful Christians, especially young people, were being bamboozled and confused by economic ideas and socialism that I had entertained in the 1980s as a college freshman when I knew nothing and when the Cold War was still going, right? And so, but I thought once the Cold War ended and the Soviet Union collapsed, that the whole debate over socialism was settled by the verdict of history and I could think about something else. So I did. Ended up back on college campuses, Christian college campuses now, mind you. I'm not talking about Montana State or whatever. I'm talking about Christian college campuses. And discovered that the same bad ideas I had had 15 years before were alive and well in the minds of 18-year-old Christian college students. And so that bugged me, and I thought, well, this is a disaster. And so that's why I actually wrote this book, Money, Greed, and God, and a bunch of other stuff. And so this isn't attention deficit disorder. I always tell people this, that I'm accused of this. I say, well, no, that's where you don't ever complete anything, though. And so if you actually finish a book on a subject, that's got to be some other personality trait, maybe obsessive compulsive disorder, right, or something like that. But I was teaching at Catholic University for a number of years, perfectly happy, sort of the kind of gig that if you're an academic, you would want this kind of gig, no real controversy, but beautiful campus, wonderful colleagues. And I wrote a book, then the lockdown happened, and that for most people, that was a disaster. For me, that saved me a bunch of commute time. And so it made me really mad. And so I and two other colleagues in different parts of the world, you don't have to shower, you don't have to shave. I didn't cut my hair for 9 months. I don't think I wore pants for 9 months. I never left the house, right? I just wear pajama bottoms. And so we wrote this book, The Price of Panic, using the time we saved from lockdowns to write a book ranting about the lockdowns, right? And I realized something that for some reason I only feel like I'm flourishing if I'm right in the middle of things, because I had to enter this fight. And so we talked a lot about that. And as a result of this, though, the book had to be published quickly, and the only publisher that can really publish things this quickly, in kind of large publishers, is Regnery Publishing in Washington, D.C. And so while the book was going through the process, purely by coincidence, my college student daughter also had a full-time job as a copy editor at Regnery, all right? Now, she was working as a fact checker for another book that was also in the pipeline at Regnery. It was called Irreversible Damage by a woman named Abigail Schreer. All right, and so she actually had to sign a statement of non-disclosure on this because it was considered so controversial. But I was a Regnery author, and so she's working on it, and so she passed me chapters of this book, all right, months before it came out. So this book is about what is happening to teenage girls at the hands of surgeons, supposedly for the purpose of curing them of gender dysphoria. You carry the book. All right? You carry the book. Okay, good. So this is a product placement ad here. All right? And so I had already been following this debate about gender ideology because of my good friend Ryan Anderson, who's also spoken here, used to be the William Simon Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. And he wrote a book called When Harry Became Sally about the kind of public policy issue early on. This book came out in, 2017 or 18, so it was really kind of ahead of the curve, talking about this stuff, and I thought, this is really bad. And I actually, at one point, after I read Abigail Schreer's manuscript, I said, this stuff is utterly diabolical, it is a strike on the human person, and it is an attack on human civilization itself. That's exactly what I thought, and my younger daughter heard this, and I even said, if Ryan ever leaves the Heritage Foundation, there need to be more backs to distribute the arrows that he's getting, because he was really savagely attacked. I can tell you, when you talk about these issues, we don't have security here, but in a lot of places, I actually have to have security to be able to talk about this in public venues, all right? So I just thought, I should really jump into that. Well, lo and behold, Ryan becomes the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, another smaller think tank in Washington, D.C., my daughter remembered that. said, Dad, remember what you said that time? And so I wasn't really, I was perfectly happy. I thought, I don't know that I need to go to do another job. But I applied for this position, and I was interviewed by the woman who at the time was the director of the DeVos Center. I'm now the director of the DeVos Center, too. That's another story. And she said, why do you want to leave your position at Catholic and come to Heritage? I said, I want to fight gender ideology because it's evil, and there need to be more people fighting it. And so this was COVID tide, right? So we were just on the phone. And she was totally silent. And I thought, I've said something crazy, haven't I? And she doesn't know how to get out of this phone call. Well, she was just sort of shocked. She said, so wait, you're fine. You're perfectly happy with your job. You're not in this fight, and you want to be in it? Is that what you're telling me? And I said, yeah, that's pretty much the story. That's my whole pitch. That was all I actually had. Well, it happened. And it was significant because this is such a controversial issue that it will not surprise you to learn that except for groups that specifically focus on family policy, almost no one wants to talk about this issue. Almost no Republican politicians want to talk about this issue. Almost no priests and pastors want to talk about this issue. And if you are a respectable public policy think tank, you don't want to talk about this issue. Right? There's no obvious upside to this. First of all, it's weird. It's creepy. It's the sort of thing that when you tell people about it, I can already feel my voice getting intense because it sounds crazy. It sounds crazy to people. That, I realize, is actually the main impediment to defeating this, is that the ordinary rational person simply does not believe that there are pediatric surgeons who want to remove healthy breasts from 16-year-old girls. Right? That just sounds completely insane, like something that the weirdest conspiracy theorist you've ever met would say. And people do not want to believe that. Right? And so persuading people that it's not only people doing that, it's happening to thousands of kids right now. Right? That is, once people realize this, what I've discovered is that people get red-pilled. Do you know what this means to be red-pilled? This is a reference to the movie The Matrix. You don't need to see the movie. The idea of a red pill is you take it and then you're awake forever. So you might have been kind of an illusion, right? You're in a dream. Somebody gives you the red pill, and you can't not know it. That's what this issue is like. And so I am absolutely convinced that we are going to beat this thing under one basic condition. We have to beat it in this time window, and we're at the opening of that time window. And so the opening of the time window is when a critical mass of the American people realize this is real, and it has to be stopped. The closing of that window, and here's the depressing part, is when everybody gets used to it. Right? Now, you don't think we will get used to it. Yes, we will. Humans are social creatures, and no matter what happens, Thomas Aquinas talks about it in the 13th century. He said he's heard tale of stories of whole cultures that believe stealing is a virtue. Right? And so almost anything, abortions in which the baby's born alive and then allowed to die, right, that a major political party could actually be for that, right? For allowing that. But that's something that most cultures in most times and places wouldn't initially be used to that. You have to be inured to it. You have to, you know, be the sort of frog in the kettle slowly boiling. That's how this is going to be. So right now, this stuff is grotesque and horrific when you first hear about it. And then that triggers a kind of anger or a desire to do something about it. And there's two things that will happen. And this is what we're going to talk about tomorrow. One is that you dissipate your frustration and anger in completely unstrategic things that don't go anywhere, right? Which is what we like to do. There's a bunch of stuff that's emotionally satisfying, like ranting, the old man ranting at the sky, you know, this is me, right? I just rant. Doesn't affect anything. That's the one danger. Or we do something strategic, or we do it so slowly that people get used to it and then it's no big deal. And I think we have about 5 years. I don't have a PhD in prophecy. That's just my guess about how long it takes cultures to get used to stuff. And so at the moment, most people still don't believe it's happening. They've heard about it because if they have access to the internet, they see it, right? And so what we're going to have is a clock is going to tick, and we will either defeat this thing in 5 years or it will be too late simply because we will be used to it. And I honestly think, because of the fact that we're striking at the root of human civilization, which is the sexual binary. That's a kind of weird academic thing to say. But there is exactly one biological function for which none of us is a complete organism. All of us, God made us as complete organisms for most functions. So as long as you're healthy, you don't need another person to be able to breathe or to eat, right, or to sleep, or any of the kinds of things that we do as adults, right? You're a complete organism. You cannot reproduce after your kind by yourself. It takes exactly one fertile man and one fertile woman, exactly one of each, to be able to reproduce. So each of us is intrinsically, biologically made incomplete, in which we function in this way biologically only when we're together. And so that is how we propagate the species. That's the, we know from social scientific research that this is the best way children are raised, is in a context with a married mother and father, right? And so that unit is the basic cell of every society and every civilization. You can have a family, a Swiss Family Robinson, without a country. You can't really have a country if you don't have any families, if you just have isolated individuals, because everybody starts as a baby, right? And they can't raise itself. All right, so that is why if you can strike at the sexual binary, and you can literally do it in a way that makes people sterile, right, you have struck at civilization. And so that's why I got involved in this thing. Not because I thought it was pleasant. I can tell you, if you're worried he's got visuals, what weird pictures is he going to show us? This will be I'm not showing you any kind of scary pictures, but I'm telling you there are scary pictures involved in this issue. Terrifying pictures that at some point if you study it, you have to research. So this thing I'm going to talk about is called gender ideology. There's a reason I'm not calling this transgenderism. And the reason is because transgenderism implies a male that wants to be a female or a female that wants to be a male. This thing's way more complicated than that, right? Maybe around 2010 it was that simple. But have you heard of nullification surgery? Have you heard of the gender identity of eunuch? Or non-binary, or pansexual. There's a bunch of these. I could go on for 5 minutes, right? But there's a bunch of these categories. And what's happened is a radically different view of the human person has managed to displace this basic common sense, it's a biblical idea, but it's also a biological idea of the sexual binary. And so what I want to do tonight and tomorrow is I'm going to unpack this. And so the first thing I want to talk about is what exactly this is. Or no, first I want to talk about sort of what's happening, honestly. So let's start with where we actually are so you know what's happening and why there is a campaign that is intentionally directed to children. Then we're going to talk about what exactly it is and what the basic claims are and what the supposed way of curing this using gender affirming care is. And then tomorrow we're going to talk about the ideologues and the billionaire donors and the transhumanists that are actually funding this thing, right? So again, if you like stories in which there's some rich billionaire men dressed like women, that's got this too, right? That's part of the story, turns out, right? You don't even have to make it up. It's right on the internet. And then finally we're going to talk about exactly how to defeat this, because there is a very specific strategy, and it's exciting to be talking about this tonight, because the state of Florida, several states have tried to deal with this issue in the last year, and there's a bunch of ways that seem to make sense at the beginning. Let's just make it a crime. Let's just make it a Class C felony. Alabama did that. They're going to court. The Department of Justice is going after them. All right? Florida pursued a completely different route, and their Board of Medicine today voted to prohibit this based upon the scientific evidence. Not the legislature, the Board of Medicine, following their Board of Health. And so Florida's actually doing what all the other states need to do, and that just happened about 3 hours ago. So that's going to happen. And so literally 3 weeks ago, I had to talk to a reporter from NPR. I pray none of you have to ever do this. And she said, don't you feel like you're on the wrong side of history, that Alabama's going to court? The Texas Supreme Court struck down what Texas is doing. The Arkansas bill prohibiting this is going to trial. You're on the wrong side of history. I knew, no, those are like the first partial steps I knew what Florida was doing, and I knew that the other states, once they saw, oh, that's how you do it. And there's a logical principle, and it goes this way. The actual proves the possible. So in other words, before something happens, like before anyone had ever climbed to the top of Mount Everest, you didn't know if it was possible. Maybe there's not a pathway up there. But once one person does it, it's actually happened, and so that proves it's possible. Once one state successfully does this, the other states don't have to reinvent the wheel. They just do what that state did. That's the moment in which we live, and we'll do this in much, much shorter order than 5 years, as long as we do it right. And I actually had, frankly, an ulterior motive for coming to Montana, because I'm hoping this is going to be one of the states in 2023 that does the same thing. And I think it can be. So that's tomorrow, all right? So we will get to how to fix this, but I want to persuade you that it's something that really, really needs to be fixed. And the longer I think about this, the more I try to distill things down to their essence, because this is a very complicated subject. You can get lost in the statistics very quickly. And so what I want to do is to kind of boil this down. And it turns out, in some ways, as a public or a cultural or an educational issue, this boils down to one central question, and this is it. Should we teach children that they may be born in the wrong body? Is that something, first of all, should we tell kids, okay, it's possible if you are uncomfortable with your body? Now, what percentage of kids at some point is uncomfortable with their body? That's just everyone, right? And it's certainly all females. From the non-representative sample, non-scientific sample of females I've talked to, it's 100% of females going through puberty or don't like their bodies, no matter what their bodies are like. And so what if the authorities told you, oh, well, you know, it's possible you were born in the wrong body. Now, I want you to just think about this for a minute, all right? First of all, is that a good idea to tell kids they might be born in the wrong body? No, it's a terrible idea. But here, there's a deeper question. What the heck could it possibly mean to say that you're born in the wrong body? Does it mean God made something like that, right? God made a mistake. Or God had this other body, presumably, right? Now, nobody saying this actually thinks much about there being a God. That's the funny thing is. But the idea is that God has this sort of warehouse of bodies. And sometimes, and he has these souls over here, right? And then he sometimes accidentally puts a girl soul in a boy body. That's the idea, right? And so that sounds crazy, but I just today read from somebody on the other side saying that, well, this was a girl that was born in a boy's body. That's the implication of gender ideology, is that you as a person could somehow have the wrong body, and if that's true, then the way to fix your problem, that discordance between you and your body, it's not to help you adjust to your body, because remember, it's your body that's wrong. The thought in your head is who you are. So the therapeutic way to fix this is to transform your body with drugs and social conditioning, something called social affirmation, and ultimately surgery. So scalpel and drug to fix an idea inside your head. Right now, that would sound crazy, except all of you actually know this is what's happening, right? And so, but when you unpack it this way, I'm doing this to show you how completely insane this is at a certain level. And it's that level of insanity that causes people to think, people can't really believe that. That just sounds absolutely crazy. And so it helps if you know a little bit about history to remember that people have believed all sorts of things in history, awful things, that we take to be crazy, but that at the time they didn't. And we are at a moment in which one of the craziest ideas ever known to man has now filled what Marx called the commanding heights of culture. In other words, all of our elite institutions, government, the corporate boardroom, the teachers' colleges, your local public schools, I promise it's in there. 2 weeks ago, Stillwater, Oklahoma had a public family-friendly drag queen event for little kids. Okay, by definition. Oh, you had one right here. Okay, I knew that you had some in Montana, but I mentioned Stillwater because Stillwater is probably the most conservative place in the country. All right, so it's absolutely everywhere. So let's talk about the cultural campaign. This is the first thing that I want to talk about tonight. All of you notice, no doubt, that there is something about this campaign that involves the direct targeting and indoctrination of children. Now, why is that? Who would want to do this? Who would intentionally want to sexualize little kids? That is, expose them to explicitly and especially divergent sexual ideas when they're young. This would not have been a partisan issue 20 years ago. I'm quite certain that most people, whether they were Republicans or Democrats or Libertarians or Green Party, would not have thought it would be a good idea to have men dressed up pornographically as weird parodies of women, sashaying their bodies like a strip club in front of little kids. That just would sound like, no, we throw people in jail for that around here, right? And that everybody would have thought that. And so the fact that everybody doesn't think that now tells you that something's wrong. It's not that that's happening, right? Because people try weird stuff all the time. It's that that would actually be contested, and some people would think, well, what's wrong with that? And that if any video that you want to pull up of this right now, what you will discover in the background is that parents have brought their children to this, right? They brought them there. So the drag queens, they didn't break into people's houses. This was a voluntary thing in which parents brought their kids, right? I tell you that because I don't want you to think, okay, well, we've got some crazy parents. We're talking like a big chunk of the population thinks this is a good idea because it's so fully permeated our culture. Now, I had a bunch of these pictures when I first started talking about this. There's no reason to show it because anybody that has access to the internet sees it. This was where it started. It was called the National Reading Day several years ago by Sarah McBridge. So Sarah McBridge is what's called a trans woman. So that means a man presenting as a woman. So, and it was around Jazz and Friends. So Jazz was Jazz Jennings. So this is a popular boy who had a popular reality, sort of reality show, in which he went through this transition process. Now, if you look up what Jazz Jennings looks like now, there's a reason there's no longer a TV show. But at the time, this was highly romanticized. And so it was around this popular TV show. And the purpose of this was just to introduce children initially to the idea of gender transition. All right, and so notice here we don't have a drag queen. All right, this looks normal. In fact, you probably wouldn't have even known who Sarah McBridge is, or you just thought this is some woman, right? It just looks like a teacher or whatever, right? You wouldn't know anything. So you notice that here it's somewhat unassuming. That's kind of how it started. Now, anyone that was paying attention knew that there were organizations that had been at this for years and knew exactly what they were doing. They planned this out over a period of years, and they knew you don't just start with the drag queen story hour. You start with something that looks unassuming like this, right? And so this doesn't look like anything now. And so I'm just going to give you, this is boring, and it's a bunch of text. I won't read the whole thing. But this is from one of many organizations called Gender Spectrum. And this is an organization that, think of this as teacher training materials in which they're telling you, how do we introduce gender ideology into schools in a way that will be palatable? All right, and so they talk about, and this is a document, and for a long time, this was actually just on the internet, right? So it wasn't like they're embarrassed about it. And they talk about entry points, so ways, points at which you can enter into the educational process, right? So I'm just going to read a little bit. I know this is tiny. When focusing on the intentional development of gender-inclusive school settings, so gender inclusion, that's the euphemism, helpful to think of terms in terms of four discrete approaches or entry points, the internal, so inside your head, the interpersonal, the instructional, and the institutional. Through deliberate work in each one of these areas, gender-inclusive practices can be woven into the fabric of the institution. So this isn't going to be one weird lesson in health class. This isn't going to be one weird book in the school library. This is going to be woven into the fabric of the institution in every class and the way every student interacts, in the way the bathrooms are configured and who is in the bathrooms, right? Everything. And so it goes through this. It's long and detailed, but it describes, let me just tell you this once. This is telling teachers, here's how you sort of introduce this stuff. Use language that challenges binary messages about gender and degenders objects. Colors don't have genders. They're just, you can like any color you want. Well, that's true. Rather than boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, etc., refer to pupils as students, children, y'all, folks, or your school's mascot like cougar or another non-gendered term for the group. So in other words, really it's just as simple as not referring to people as boys and girls. That seems really, really innocent by itself, right? If that's the only thing that happened, okay, cougars, you wouldn't even recognize what was going on, right? This is the work of smart people that are thinking way ahead of us and have been doing it for years, right? They plan this out in exquisite detail, right? So that's what was happening. So that's how we went from things that looked like this just a few years ago to things that look like this now, right? Now, most people, and you don't have to be a conservative Christian, I don't think. I think that just by a natural instinct, if you just brought someone, I don't know, just a random pagan person that hadn't been exposed to this stuff, and you showed them this, they would find it repugnant. Because it's just something visceral about it. There's this thing that anthropologists talk about, the incest taboo that people just sort of have, and you have to break that down. Now, what is going on here? Right? So this is a little kid, right? Now, this would normally be terrifying, but you should understand that what's happening here is a quite intentional campaign to break down and deconstruct the categories that a child will be developing in this age so that they do not develop those categories. Because normally, then the kind of basic category is that kids in normal development, once they're 5 or 6, they know that there are boys and girls, and there are adults and children, right? And I can still remember this. In the first grade, I grew up, it was in the 1970s in the first grade, and kids, everybody kind of had long hair. And I remember there was this kid in my first grade class, and I was unclear whether he was a boy or a girl. It wasn't that he dressed like a girl. You're 6, right? And his hair was long. And then he was in the Cub Scouts with me. That's a boy, right? So you're still kind of learning it, and little kids are sometimes hard to distinguish. That's why we use the color schemes, right? And so this is a small toddler. She's probably barely speaking, right? And so what's she see here? I don't know exactly, right? But whatever it is, it's absolutely designed to break down the sexual binary from this child's social categories, right? And so it has to start here. If you've got social revolution on your mind, right, and you want to overturn something that's as stable as biology, universal biology that every culture and every time and place recognized, right? This is not sectarian theological stuff. This is stuff that every culture and every time and place has understood. How do you break that down? This is how you break it down. And you do it everywhere, and you do it at all times, and you do it at all places. And so it has to happen in the schools. All right, now I know that sounds, I'm going through this slowly because this is so bad that you don't want to believe it. Or you want to think, okay, I heard about the Drag Queen Story Hour nearby, but this is really mostly in Berkeley, right? It's not in my school's library, is it? I bet it is, unless you've checked. So here's 3 of many books, all designed for kindergarten, all right? Now, kindergarten books, for those of y'all that don't remember this from kindergarten, kids don't read well in kindergarten for the most part. And so kindergarten books are designed for the teacher to read along with the kids, usually in a circle, got lots of pictures, you've got very memorable texts. And these are three of the more popular ones, all of which are designed to help kids learn gender ideology. Now, they don't call it gender ideology. They say something like a guide to gender identity, right? Which is actually a new category. Nobody even had this term 15 years ago, for the most part, the word gender identity. Now, note, so to have a book like this, I can tell you children's books, people will often say that are not authors, I want to write kids' books. Kids' books are the hardest possible books to get published because you need art. It's actually really hard to write for kids. It's not, you know, you're almost better off writing some nonfiction book on the COVID lockdowns or something. It's way easier, right? And to get these through the pipeline, so you got to get an author, you got to get an illustrator. And if you're going to get these in school libraries, you've also got to set up a procedure so they get adopted. So you need awards ceremonies that will give these awards medallions, right? So the books get these medallions so that then when school boards are considering new books to adopt, well, this has been awarded by the Caldecott or something or other, right? And so it ends up in your school's library. What that means is that the plan for the book is at least 5 years ago. So by the time it shows up on the shelf for kindergartners or in a classroom, that you're seeing it at the very, very end. Somebody was thinking about this a long time ago. So what do these books say? So one is who are you? One is called It Feels Good to Be Yourself. One is They, She, He, Me, Free to Be. Again, right? This just sounds like Sesame Street or something, right? It doesn't sound terrible. So again, these are books for kids ages 5 to 8. Let me just read you the summary distillation of It Feels Good to Be Yourself. Some people are boys, some people are girls, some people are both, neither, or somewhere in between. Right? So when you're 5 years old, right, and maybe you get this book 5 or 10 times. Right? I mean, this is your teacher. This is your authority figure. This is the person your parents have dropped you off to hang out with and to learn from. So all the signs of authority and trustworthiness are around this person, and this person's teaching you this, right? And when the parents hear about it, what do they say? Well, the principal's a Christian, so maybe it's not a big deal, right? That is what happens, because I've had knockdown, drag-out arguments with people about this, that I don't care about the principal, what's happening in the classroom, and what the heck's the principal doing? This is what's happening. And I'm showing you the non-pornographic stuff, all right? So I could show you Genderqueer, right? That's another book. I'm not going to show you that. I have a friend that says, Jay, you got to show people the really awful stuff. You can Google that. This is actual pornographic graphic novels that are all throughout the country, right? And so I'm just going to tell you it's called Genderqueer if you want to know. I'm sorry, I know that so high schoolers here and college students, you probably already have seen this on Instagram. So, but this is the tame stuff, all right? I'm giving you the tame stuff. So this has all happened just in the last few years. But it's not just in the schools. It's absolutely everywhere. So I don't know if y'all remember. So it was in 2015 that the Supreme Court handed down the Obergefell decision. The Obergefell decision was the decision that had to do with same-sex marriage, right? And what the Supreme Court did in a kind of incoherent Supreme Court decision is they struck down states' marriage laws that had defined marriage as between a man and a woman. Now, these laws weren't designed to torment people who identify as gay. What these laws did is they said, well, marriage is a social institution that recognizes and protects this sexual reality of male and female by which we give rise to children, and it's a recognition of that's the context in which children should be raised, and that's just what marriage is. And so whatever could happen between two people of the same sex or 3 or 12 people or whatever, it could be something, but it's not going to be marriage, right? And so lots of states had recognize this. This is nothing controversial. There was a massive campaign starting with the 90s to get rid of these. It succeeded in 2015. And what happened? In 5 seconds. If you were paying attention to the media, there was a Supreme Court decision overturning laws on natural marriage, so establishing same-sex marriage nationally. And then a completely different issue having to do with gender ideology. Right, because this isn't the same issue, right? Remember, same-sex marriage has to do with sexual orientation, or that is who you're romantically or sexually attracted to. This is a different thing. In fact, same-sex marriage implies that there are people of the same sex. Here's the irony, right? Is that homosexuality, the word itself presupposes the sexual binary. If you're a gay man, that means you are a man who likes other men, right? And so this actually contradicts the basic idea. Now, they both have to do with sex and the sexual revolution, right? But this is a different issue. And yet, almost immediately, every major publication in the country, and in fact in the world, if you've been paying attention, suddenly did this, right? So this is a famous drag queen. It's called The Transgender Tipping Point. This was a CoverGirl ad in CoverGirl's campaign for makeup for boys. He's wearing more makeup than I've ever seen a girl wear, right? Because boys need to do that to look anything like a girl, right? Okay, this is The Atlantic, right? This is National Geographic, right, with the picture of a boy that looks like a girl. And then this is all the logos that immediately change. Corporate logos. So corporate logos and brands, companies spend millions of dollars on their brands. And yet on a dime, virtually all of them change the colors of their logo. I want you to see how significant, that is world historic in its significance, that maybe 100 massive corporations could simultaneously alter on a dime their branding and their logos. So what was going on? Why would the moment same-sex marriage was established federally, suddenly the next day we're talking about gender ideology and transgender stuff? I'm not going to answer that question now. I want it to bug you. I want it to wake you up in the middle of the night. Now, how did that happen? Because there's actually a really simple explanation for why that happened. So as a result of this, as you might not be surprised, kids have been getting it and now getting it for years from the authority figure. So you can think of that as from the kind of bottom up, right? Or maybe that's from the top down. But they've also been getting it from media and from social media. So I'm not going to show you the social media stuff. This is all print publications. So this is all the kind of really staid traditional stuff. To really show you where kids are getting this, I would need to show you the TikTok influencers. But I don't want to give TikTok any more publicity than it actually deserves, since it's probably a communist Chinese plot to track us. But social media influencers, what these are is these are usually young people. And when it comes to the gender stuff, what they're doing is they themselves are going through a gender transition. So it means it might be a girl that's on testosterone. We'll talk more about this later. And she's talking about how awesome it is and how it's solving all her problems, right? And so it's a very sunny kind of presentation. And she gives what looks like an autobiographical description. And then kids that are perpetually online get sucked into this. And this is where probably the vast majority of them initially get this idea. So what we have now, right, is a massive contagion of this presentation of a particular symptom that's called gender dysphoria. So we've always had this. There have always been a very rare number of people, usually young boys before puberty, that have what's called gender dysphoria. And that's just the sense that, like, they think that maybe I'm not really a boy, right? And they feel discordant between their sex and their identity, and that's called gender dysphoria. But it was a very, very rare condition. There's another set, but it's also male, of men that go through this in their 40s. That's so weird, I'm not even going to talk about it in this series, all right? But just let me tell you this, the men that go through this in their 40s, that is a completely different thing than everything else we're talking about, psychologically, and it's not even related to this, all right? So we're just going to focus on the kids. So that's what was happening. Right, is it a very rare, I'm talking like, you could be a pediatrician and you might spend your entire career and you might encounter one child in your entire career that would have these symptoms, right? And it would almost always be a boy. And what happened with these kids? Well, they would get therapy, right? Hopefully their parents would love them and would be welcoming and loving to them. And the vast, vast majority of them would outgrow this after they went through puberty. It turns out that if you're a male, having your body washed over with testosterone for several years has a way of confirming your masculinity, right? And so puberty looks to be probably the best known cure for this type of gender dysphoria as long as you continue on the natural pathway, all right? That's not what we're dealing with now. In fact, we have a massive, massive increase of girls, and we have kids that suddenly present with these symptoms that didn't show any of these symptoms before. So it'll be girls, sometimes whole friend groups, that will suddenly come out together and tell their parents that they're non-binary or they're really a boy or they're pansexual or they're asexual. There's a bunch of these kinds of things. This is so bad that a very careful researcher at Brown University named Lisa Lippman wrote a paper in which she described as very carefully as a hypothesis a new problem, a new psychological or social problem called rapid onset gender dysphoria, in which you just suddenly it presents itself and it spreads through a population. Now, if you've studied anything about social manias historically, what you will discover is that social manias, if you think of social manias as if they're a virus, right? And so a virus, it can spread, certain different kinds of viruses spread rapidly through some parts of the population and not others. Social manias tend to spread among teenage girls. Now, why is that? Well, if you think about it, teenage girls, girls mature more quickly than boys do. They are way, way more social, and they're way more attuned to what their friends are doing. So I've got only daughters, and they're incredibly complex, and they don't make any sense. Boys are not complicated for the most part, right? Girls, they have this incredible kind of refined sense of what other girls are doing and what they're thinking, and as a result, that's why these things can spread, so that if one friend does this, several friends will do it. So the Salem witch trials, this is the population that spread through. Right? So Lisa Littman very carefully pointed this out. She was a professor of public health at Brown. She said, you know, we may be dealing with something called rapid onset gender dysphoria. We need to research it more carefully. Just kind of floated it out there. What do you think happened to Lisa Littman as a result of saying this? She was savaged. Right? So she's no longer at Brown. She's still doing research, but she's having to do it independently, just as a result of pointing this out. Now, why wouldn't, you know, if this was just about helping kids, if this was happening, if a weird kind of social contagion was spreading through the population, why would you want to silence that? Why wouldn't you want to kind of get hold of it? That's what happened. Well, there is no doubt, anybody that deals with this objectively now, because when she pointed this out in 2017, it was just kind of getting started. But the nice thing, it's actually hard to get numbers on this, but the UK has only one major pediatric gender clinic called the Tavistock Clinic. They have socialized medicine. So I'm going to give you the one good thing about socialized medicine is that it's a controlled system, and so you have all the data, right? Because it's like, sorry, you got only one doctor doing that, right? In the United States, different people are trying different things. And so we have perfect data here for the increase of gender dysphoria in the UK. So this is a diagram. So I don't know if y'all can see that. So over here, you've got 2010 to 2011, right? The green is female, age 12 to 17, right? And the gray just means unknown because we quit tracking male and female in the last few years. Why do you think that is? Right? Okay, so you don't even need to look at the details. That's from 2010 to 2011 to 2021, 22. You see that big dip? Guess what happened in that big dip? That's 2020, 21, right? It was COVID, right? So we couldn't do this stuff. So there's a dip, but that is a massive spike. So some of you may have heard that in the UK in July, the Tavistock Clinic closed. The UK government closed the Tavistock Clinic. Now, why would they do that? Well, it turns out there was a physician named Hilary Cass that had been doing an independent review of this, and was discovering some things like this. And she started looking into the data and kind of tracking the kids that were being treated in this clinic. Turns out it wasn't working so well, right? It was creating problems and not solving a lot of problems. And then, though, just bottom line, if you've got one pediatric gender clinic, right, and you're dealing with, what is that, maybe 80 cases, and then 10 years later, you're dealing with 5,000 cases, and it's the same office, that's a catastrophe. You can't keep treating that, can you? And so that's a massive increase. So that gives it visually. Another estimate done by Abigail Schreer suggests that the increase in kids presenting with these symptoms, so they get referred to the Tavistock Clinic by their pediatrician in the UK, increased from 2009 to 2019 by 4,400%. So 44 times more kids. Right now, anyone with like three neurons connected should be able to figure out, okay, this isn't spreading through the water, right? Am I really supposed to believe that all these problems are already there? This is the claim on the other side. Is that, well, no, this has always been there. It's like left-handedness. It's just that the culture suppressed it, and now the culture is more friendly, and so now this is all coming to the fore. This is ridiculous. First of all, it's happening in countries that didn't suppress this. And so they're also claiming that the country is going through a moral panic and suppressing it at the same time. So it's clear that we're dealing with a social contagion and we need to figure out what exactly is going on. The good news is the UK has already figured this out. The National Health Service just issued statements 2 weeks ago saying from now on we're going to treat this as if it's a phase, effectively. We're going to treat it with psychotherapy. We're going to deal with kids' comorbidities, in other words, their psychological problems that are connected to this. And we're not going to assume that they're always going to be there, and so we need to get them on puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones. So this is, tide's already turning in some countries that started this before we did. Also happening in Finland and Sweden, believe it or not. So don't let people tell you this is just a right-wing, left-wing thing. All right? That's the reality of what we're dealing with. It's come, it's bombarded children intentionally, and it's leading to a social contagion that's an actual, leads to actual kind of physical pathologies, but it's transmitting itself socially. That is the problem. That's the first thing I wanted to talk about. Now we'll take a break for 10 minutes, Dick, and then come back and I'll tell you what
to talk about. Your books first.
Oh, I have to talk about the books. Okay, so you heard about Money, Green, God. It has nothing to do with what we're talking about tonight. These books are really, really good. I'm going to talk about the best books to read if you want to totally know everything. This is The Heavy Book by Carl Truman that he wrote, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. It's a great book. It's also pretty heavy, and when he wrote it...
Could we have some quiet, please?
Ryan Anderson told him, okay, that's a great book, but most people can't read a book like that. Why don't you write a better distillation of it? And so Carl did it. This is a book called Strange New World, foreword by Ryan Anderson, that's a distillation of his kind of philosophical analysis of how we got where we got. And so these are the first couple of books that I will recommend. So we'll talk about what gender ideology is in the next session, but I want to take a break so that everyone's not...